Hello and welcome to Iris for Sunday, July 3rd, 2022. Tomorrow obviously is 4th of July, so I wish you all have a happy and safe 4th. And for today, we will read the paper. First, let's take a examination of the weather for the next 5 days. Today, again, the weather will be very warm, breezy in the afternoon. Winds will be about 8 to 16 miles per hour. And a high of 90 degrees. Tonight it'll be humid. We could have a strong thunderstorm late in the evening. Wind will be 8 to 16 miles per hour and a low of 74 degrees. Monday, 4th of July, a heavy thunderstorm in the morning, breezy, winds 10 to 20 miles per hour, a high of 100, a low of 74. Tuesday, it'll be hot with clouds and sun, winds 6 to 12 miles per hour, high of 99, low of 71. Wednesday, very warm with clouds and sun, winds 6 to 12 miles per hour, high of 94, low of 70. Thursday, humid with a thunderstorm in spots, high of 89 and a low of 67. We will now turn to the front page of today's paper, where we have news from Saturday in the Park and the local South Sioux City Senior Center. First, the mini editorial at the bottom of the page. This one is signed by Tim Pluger of Lamars, Iowa. And Tim writes, "When God is happy, the human race benefits. Thanks to the SCOTUS, or Supreme Court of the United States, for their abortion ruling on Roe v. Wade. That takes us one step closer to making God happy." Signed, Tim Pluger of Lamars, Iowa. All right, let's look to the top story of today's newspaper, and the headline reads, "Back at Square One." Subheadline, "South Sioux City Senior Center begins quest to reopen, rebuild." From South Sioux City. Nearly a month after the South Sioux City Senior Center shut down, efforts to revive the center are basically starting at square one, according to one volunteer. Quote, "If we do not start now, it is only going to get more difficult to revive the center's services," said volunteer Bill Garvey Sr. The city is assisting the center in its efforts to resume operations, but a lack of volunteers, an increase in requests for services, and a need for funds to pay for replacement delivery vans have slowed progress. The center officially shut down on June 6, but its march towards closing began more than 2 years ago. At the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, the center received an increased number of requests for its services. Because it's dependent on volunteers to handle day-to-day tasks, it became overwhelmed. The Meals on Wheels program, which serves about 90 individuals, needs volunteers to deliver one meal a day, 5 days a week. A substantial portion of the volunteers were other elderly members of the community. Being at higher risk of major complications or even death from the virus, many had to stop their work. According to Garvey, community involvement was already on the decline. The number of volunteers before the start of the pandemic, quote, isn't what it used to be 10 or 20 years ago. An already low volunteer base was even more diminished. Due to the shallow volunteer pool, the remaining volunteers paid workers had to pick up the slack. At one point in May, the last cook was doing 3 different tasks, cooking, making deliveries, and watching the elderly at the center, all while being paid the same amount as she was before. The cook left the center around the end of May. Financial issues also contributed to the center's closing. Before the spike in gas prices in the last few months, delivery drivers were able to justify spending some of their own money on fuel to make deliveries. But fewer drivers meant more mileage, and more mileage meant more fuel. Longer delivery routes combined with rising gas prices led to expensive receipts at the pump, something that many volunteers could not be available for or afford. Garvey said those factors led to fewer volunteers and fewer donations. "Getting donations is not as easy as it used to be," said Garvey. "Community drive is still there, but justifying the donation is difficult given the circumstances." Rising food costs also added to the problems. While donations and state and federal funding were enough to cover most operations, those who utilized the food service were given an invoice for a recommended donation amount. Quote, "We kept the donation amount at $4 a meal," said South Sioux City Senior Center board member Clara Wotan. "For 20 meals a month, the total monthly recommended donation was $80. But while the costs remain low, some were not able to pay, and the difference between the cost of food production and the number of people using the meals began to draw closer. Garvey noted that the donation receipts did not increase proportionally with increased expenses when speaking on what was discovered in a review of the center's financial records. With concerns surrounding the ability to socially distance in the center, requests for delivered meals increased. And with little understanding of how COVID-19 spread at the time, extra packaging was used to deliver the food, increasing costs. Due to Title III of the Older Americans Act, passed by Congress in 1965, those who received the delivered meals could not be denied service if they did not voluntarily donate. Quote, since there is government money involved, the senior center could not stop delivering meals to anyone due to inability to pay the donation amount, said Garvey. The money Garvey is referring to came from the Northeast Nebraska Area Agency on Aging. Funding from the agency was held up from May 19th to June 6th due to issues keeping the temperature of the food high or low enough during the delivery process. Connie Cooper, executive director of the Northeast Nebraska Area on Aging, said that the temperature range is, quote, above 135 degrees Fahrenheit for hot meals and below 41 degrees Fahrenheit for cold meals. Quote, the agency monitors a number of services that the senior center provides, said Cooper. To ensure safety, the temperature of the food is one thing we monitor. The food was tested upon departure and return, and the center failed the test when we were there, both unannounced and unannounced. It was then that Cooper became aware of the senior center's financial troubles. When the center stopped its Meals on Wheels program, state funding resumed. Quote, all funds since June 6 have been released to the center, said Cooper. Hopefully, they can resume operations soon. The center was experiencing its fair share of downs, but the loss of one team member was the last straw. In mid-April, South Sioux City Senior Center's director Tom Rich informed the board that he was retiring. Quote, if we knew at the beginning of the year that he would be retiring, we would have stepped up, said Wooten. Quote, but we did not know until a couple weeks before. Rich had been the director of the center for 19 years. Quote, he was a leader here, Garvey said. You have to have a passion to do this job. It's not easy to replace. There are sacrifices you have to make. According to Wooten, Rich received training from the state of Nebraska before assuming the mantle. The director he chose to succeed him, a former cook at the center, received no such training. Quote, she left the position after a month, working from May 1st to the end of May, Wooten said. She did a lot of deliveries and such, but they did not have the time or knowledge to complete the task. With training, she would have been better off. Cooper said she was aware of Rich's departure, but was never officially notified of who would fill his role. The Northeast Nebraska Agency on Aging is also responsible for training the director. Board members declined to provide the most recent director's name, so the director could not be reached for comment. Her departure left two vacancies at the center, which also included the cook. Soon after, board members resigned too. Lois Daniels was the one member to remain. Quote, after they all left, we had an election to fill the spots and build up again, said Daniels. Clara was one who stepped up to fill the hole. This was not Wooten's first time on the board. She had been on and off the board over the past 15 years. Daniel has been a board member for the last 7 years. Since the center closed, the board as well as community members have been working closely with the city to forge a plan to resume operations. Lance Hedquist, South Sioux City's city administrator, said the city and the board are meeting two times a week to discuss plans. Quote, this is a very high priority for the community, Hedquist said. We are still establishing a financial budget, but we have had some people come forward to volunteer and get paid jobs. For those who receive the Meals on Wheels service, its importance goes beyond that of simply having something to eat. A person come by to check on the elderly is just as valuable, Garvey said. Quote, South Sioux still has the feel of a small town. You do not necessarily know everybody, but there's always somebody that will look out for them. With Meals on Wheels, someone was checking in every day, he said. The date when Meals on Wheels will resume is unknown. Those working towards reopening that say ensuring financial integrity is the first step in resuming services for the center. Quote, we have two retired accountants reviewing financial data from past years, he said. We consider it due diligence. We do not have any suspicions, but it will give us and any donors peace of mind. Wooten and Daniels both expressed interest in completing a business plan before entertaining any donors. Quote, we know it is going to be a tough task, but if we do not start now, it is only going to get more difficult to revive the center services, Garvey said. So that's about the status of the South Sioux City Senior Center. And we wish them well. Hopefully they can get back to serving the senior citizens of South Sioux City. Here's actually a little box. If it says how to help. So if you or know someone that might be able or willing to help out the South Sioux City Senior Center, it says individuals, organizations, and businesses wanting to be involved in any portion of reopening the South Sioux City Senior Center should contact the city administrator's office at 402-494-7517. So basically looks like get in touch with City Hall in South Sioux City and they should be able to get you in contact with those and see how if you can help out with the senior center. All right, let's return back to the front page of today's paper where we look to the big summer event of Sioux City, which is obviously Saturday in the Park. And this was, I believe, the 30th anniversary of Saturday in the Park, the free concert series that occurs in Grandview Park. Headline, Saturday in the Park 2022. And there's a front page photo spread of, it's a lot of people looking towards the stage, and it's taken basically from the perspective as if you were the musician playing on stage and all the people are looking at you. Subheadline, the music festival is back as a one-day event from Sioux City. After a COVID cancellation in 2022 and switching to a two-day affair in 2021, the 2022 installment of Sioux City's Saturday in the Park was back to a one-day bonanza of bands, fans, food, and vendors. A little more than a half hour before the free music festival kicked off, attendees could be seen streaming into the 32-acre Grandview Park. A potent smell of barbecue, Euro meat, and fries wafted through the food concourse as a drummer was heard thwacking away at his kit during a sound check on the band shell. Then, the lower area of the main stage was mostly empty. An hour in, the park was fully alive. Lines were forming at vendors like Smoking R's Barbecue, which came all the way up from Florida to supply festival goers with ribs, brisket, and pulled pork sandwiches. In the kids' zone, kids were harnessed and scaling the rock wall or navigating through an inflatable obstacle course or watching clown extraordinaire Special K's move bubbles through the air with an array of wands. Some folks were plenty content to just sit in their chairs and listen to the music no matter who was playing. "Cole, we just love being here," said Rhonda Hawks and her husband Mike, age 60 and 65, who drove 28 miles down from Akron, Iowa for the event. "But we love the community, just bringing people together," Rhonda said. Mike added that he had been to as many as 30 installments of Saturday in the Park and couldn't recall a single fight or fracas. Lyle Huff, 60, drove over an hour from Ashton, Iowa, and said he too has been to nearly every Saturday in the Park and also didn't remember seeing anything getting out of hand. Quote, "Everybody's just enjoying themselves," Huff said. For him, the best the festival ever got was when the blues legend B.B. King performed at it in 2007. So he was plenty of excited at the prospect of hearing King's old touring mate, Buddy Guy, take the main stage at 6:15 p.m. By the 6 o'clock hour, with the temperatures hovering around 82 degrees, Saturday in the Park co-founder Dave Bernstein said at least 25,000 people were in attendance. Relative newcomers to the festival, like Blaine Grease, prioritized other experiences. The 13-year-old said he was most excited to see hip-hop artist Fetty Rap, who scored a major hit in 2015 with the song Trap Queen. Deborah Harper, 65, came to her first Saturday in the Park mostly to browse the Arts Alley, which included a number of clothers and get some donuts. First-time performers at the festival, such as Tori Semenik of the groove-heavy metal group Fall of Kings, and rapper Richard Miller marveled at the chance they got to perform on Saturday in the Park's Abe stage. Quote, "My voice is totally gone now," Miller said after wrapping up. "It was amazing to perform with the other artists too." Before the show, Semenik let a number of women paint on her body as a way for them to express their own feelings. That communal engagement extended to the performance itself. Quote, "Everyone in the band has contributed to the lyrics," Semenik said. Quote, "It's not just me singing my own lyrics, but me singing for everybody." Mariah St. Cyr, a.k.a. Raya Dawn, became the first female Native American rapper to perform at the festival and didn't take the opportunity for granted one bit. Quote, it was crazy. A little surreal. It means a lot. Last year I was just performing at bars and now I'm here. I think this is the biggest crowd I've been in front of, she said. Quote, I'm still trying to come out on top, trying to make it. Maybe people can see me up there and maybe think they can make it for themselves. New Orleans-based group Terrence Simonon and the Zydeco Experience had just 2 days' notice that they were playing after the band Daisy the Great dropped out. The group, which won a Grammy in 2008 for Best Zydeco or Cajun Music Album, played songs filled with bass, brass, and keyboard riffs, all while tossing purple, gold, and green beads to the crowd. Even with the crowd swelling throughout the day, there were a few safety-related incidents. According to Lieutenant Joe Rodriguez, the Sioux City Fire Rescue Deputy Fire Marshal, up until about 4 p.m., only one person had to go to the safety tent. They had overheated, Rodriguez said. That degree of ease is something Bernstein also spoke to in a chat with the Journal. Quote, just felt very smooth this year, he said via text. So, that's to report. It sounds like a successful Saturday in the park, and I actually went myself last evening, and it was a really good time for everyone involved. All right, we will now return back to the front page of today's Sunday paper for the final story of local and state interest. It is regarding the landscape for abortion in the state of Iowa and beyond. Headline, Legal Battle Over Medication Abortion. Subheadline, Telehealth Providers Navigating Changing Landscape. From the Cedar Rapids Gazette. With Iowa Republican leaders likely to restrict access to abortion in the state following the United States Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade this past month, a potential legal battle over access to abortion pills is brewing. Medication abortions account for more than half the abortions in Iowa, as well as more than half of all abortions in the United States, and are often obtained by patients through telehealth appointments. Businesses offering abortion pills through the mail has grown in recent years and likely will continue growing as the country becomes a patchwork of abortion access. But whether states can ban the actual medication itself, which has approval from a top federal agency, is the next question that may be answered in the upcoming court cases, some experts have said. Question, what is a medication abortion? Answer. Medication abortion involves taking two different medications that can be administered up to 10 weeks gestation. The first is mifepristone, which is followed by misoprostol 1 or 2 days later. Since the U.S. Food and Drug Administration first approved the drug regimen in 2000, its use nationwide has grown rapidly. As of 2020, medication abortion has become the most common method for elective abortions, making up 54% of abortions in the United States, according to the Guttmacher Institute. By comparison, in 2017, it accounted for 39% of all abortions nationwide. The majority of abortions in Iowa in recent years have been medically induced, surpassing the number of surgical abortion procedures in the past decade or so, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. In 2022, there were 3,222 medically induced abortions compared to the 835 surgical abortions in Iowa, according to the latest data from the State Health Department. The IDPH first began reporting medically induced abortions in reports from 2005. That year, public health officials say there were 1,753 medical abortions compared to 4,128 surgically induced abortions. Iowa likely to restrict telemedicine abortions. With the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn the landmark 1973 case that established federal abortion protections, 13 states already have enacted laws that ban nearly all abortions, including medication abortions. It's likely that GOP-led states, including Iowa, could go further. Some states have already proposed legislation that would ban telehealth appointments with abortion providers, and some have attempted to make it a crime for an out-of-state provider to provide abortion services to a resident. Sally Frank, a Drake University law professor, said if Iowa restricts or bans abortions, telemedicine abortions similarly would be restricted or banned. Frank said the question is what would happen if an Iowa woman attempted to obtain abortion medication via telemedicine in a state where abortion remained legal. In such an instance, the out-of-state physician would mail the abortion medication to the Iowa woman. Quote, that remains to be decided legally, Frank said. I think it would be difficult to try to bring that provider under Iowa law. Governor Kim Reynolds and other Republican state house leaders did not respond to requests for comments about how they might approach regulating telemedicine abortions. Reynolds did tell reporters earlier this past week that she did not plan to call a special legislative session to pass abortion restrictions, but did say she may consider it if her efforts to bring back Iowa's, quote, fetal heartbeat law fails. For now, Reynolds is asking the Iowa Supreme Court to rehear a recent case with the hopes the court will establish legal standards for future abortion restrictions. She also was asking state courts to lift the injunction on a 2018 law that would ban abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, which often is before a woman knows she is pregnant. During this year's session, the Iowa's legislature, 21 Republicans in the Iowa House signed on to legislation that would ban telemedicine abortions. But the bill, House File 2119, did not advance past the early steps of the lawmaking process. Despite their agenda-setting majorities, Republicans did not pass any abortion-related legislation during this most recent session. Leaders said they preferred to wait for the U.S. Supreme Court and Iowa Supreme Court rulings on abortion cases. Both were delivered earlier this month. Abortion, including medication abortion, is legal up to 20 weeks in Iowa. Telehealth providers navigating challenging legal landscape. Planned Parenthood, the state's largest abortion provider, offers telehealth abortions at its clinics across the state. Patients schedule a virtual visit with a provider at one of its health centers where they receive the first pill to take at the clinic. They are given the second pill to take at home the next day. For Iowans, with rapid expansion of telehealth during the pandemic, access to abortion has grown beyond brick-and-mortar facilities. Nowadays, individuals can receive these pills in the privacy of their home with a video call to a provider and a credit card. Options for Iowans are increasing as companies that offer virtual abortion care rapidly have expanded their services nationwide. All right, we'll now turn to the opinion section, or page A10 of today's Sunday paper. First, we'll do the editorial, which is about several new laws that have taken effect here in Iowa. And then we will go to the letters to the editor, which we looks like we have three. All right. The editorial says, some thoughts about a series of new laws in Iowa from the Journal Editorial Board. They write, there's an interesting mix of laws that went into effect in Iowa on Friday, July 1st. If you just peruse the list, you'd come to the conclusions about those who wanted them passed. A few thoughts. Childcare. Childcare centers can now operate with one worker for every 7 2-year-olds and one for every 10 3-year-olds. Care providers who are 16 or 17 years old can also now work unsupervised. The changes are supposed to address a shortage of childcare workers, but it's questionable whether they'll achieve the proponents' goals. How many people would want to work at a center where two staffers are charged with herding 17 kids under the age of 4? The new regulations appear to fall short of improving childcare or addressing the need for higher wages for workers. Searching garbage. Police can now search an individual's garbage without a search warrant. It sounds harmless enough, but what happens if someone other than the owner tosses something into that receptacle? Is the homeowner still responsible? We see the efficacy of the law. We're just not sure it addresses how the law enforcement wants to use it. Years ago, if you dug into a post office wastebasket, you could be charged with tampering with the mail. Now, it seems, anything is fair game as long as the outcome is favorable to those looking. ATVs on more highways. All-terrain and off-road utility vehicles can travel on more country, county, and state highways now. That seems like a recipe for disaster no matter who wanted it. Because we know how some people treat these vehicles, it's unlikely some enthusiasts are going to avoid racing them now that they have more access. Cities and counties should keep a close eye on this to make sure they're not creating a new hazard. Third-party delivery services. If DoorDash, Grubhub, or Uber Eats apps use a restaurant's logo or menu without permission, they could be fined. Fair enough. If they don't adhere to food safety regulations, they could be too. We're good at that. But the delivery services may charge additional fees as long as they're noted needs a bit more study. Often when you use a delivery app, you don't know about those fees or tips or driver's costs until you've gotten to the submit order button. Fees should be revealed up front. Tips shouldn't be automatically factored in. Governor Kim Reynolds signed more than 150 bills into law this year. Some are more controversial than others, but all bear input from Iowans. Before the next session starts, Val, you'll pay attention. Some ideas don't need to go to the governor's desk. All right, let's now do the letters to the editor. This first one is titled, Iowa Bottle Bill Changes Inconvenience Consumers. When Iowa's bottle bill was originally passed in 1978, consumers could easily return empty containers to local retailers and get a refund for their 5-cent deposit. Well, now retailers can now avoid taking containers if they are licensed to prepare ready-to-eat food or are located with a certain distance from a redemption center or mobile redemption center. The distance is 10 miles in counties with 30,000 or more residents and 15 miles for smaller communities. Beverage distributors pay the 3-cent fee to the redemption centers, up from the previous 1-cent fee. However, beverage distributors get to keep the full 5 cents on each container that isn't redeemed. What a windfall to them. The original bottle bill was a convenience to consumers. Now the legislation has morphed into a windfall to beverage distributors on unredeemed containers and consumer inconvenience to drive, sometimes up to 15 miles to a redemption center. Signed, James Hopkins of Sioux City. Next letter is titled, High Court Rulings Mix Government and Religion. They write, I have many religious friends. Most are from one Christian denomination or another. Some are Buddhist, Gaian, Jewish, Muslim, Unitarian, or other less well-known sects. I know their faith provides them comfort and sustains them in difficult times. I respect their religious beliefs, but I do not share them. My friend will usually discuss their beliefs, systems, but do not try to impose them on me. That is why we are still friends. The United States of America was founded as a country that respected religious pluralism. Legal scholars agree that the First Amendment to the Constitution prohibits government from establishing an official religion and does not allow government actions that favor one religion over another. It also prohibits the government from preferring religion over non-religion or non-religion over religion. There is a growing cancer within the Republican Party that ignores the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment and has metastasized to infect the Supreme Court due to the appointment of 3 justices by a former president, best known for misogyny, temper tantrums, and inciting an insurrection. The Dobbs decision ignores 50 years of settled law and takes away the rights of women. Other decisions also indicate that this court is willing to mix government and religion, and that is un-American. The November midterm elections are critical to sending a message that the Christo-fascist movement within the Republican Party is not only un-American, but also unacceptable. Please vote. Signed, William Deeds, Sioux City. Next, the final letter is titled, Women Should Have the Right to Choose an Abortion. And the letter writer writes, I am a lifelong Democrat, and my own personal belief is that abortion should only be for victims of rape or incest. And for a woman facing a health crisis or losing her life, I also believe that every woman has a right to decide what she does with her own body as far as her health and mental well-being goes. It is not up to a bunch of old men on the Supreme Court to decide. It is time to teach the schools more responsibility about sex and having children. It's a part of life and needs to be addressed. Men also need to be held responsible and stop blaming women. The Republican stance seems to be have the child, and if you don't want it, just give it away. Do you realize how many children never get adopted and live out their lives in foster care, going from home to home, and end out on the streets when they reach 18? All children should be cared for in a decent home when they have food to eat and love surrounding them. What about the children brought into this world drug addicted, and who will care for them? Abortion should be a woman's right. Only God can judge us, not the Supreme Court. Signed, Linda Johnson, Sioux City. All right, we'll now turn to the sports section of today's paper, or Section B. Well, first we'll look to prep baseball from Sergeant Bluff. Headline, Lutgen leads Warriors in key victory from Sergeant Bluff. Despite district baseball pairings for Class 3A Substate 1 being released before Friday's game between MOC Floyd Valley and Sergeant Bluff Luton, there was still something to prove for the third-seeded Warriors. Quote, we talked about if we win or lose, big or close, it is really irrelevant, Warriors coach Matt Nelson said. The seeding is done, this isn't a conference game, so it really means very little. But it also means a lot, and I think that our kids picked up on that. This is a big game against a potential team we can see down the road, depending on how everything works out. Friday night's game turned out to be a battle, going into extra innings, but the Warriors broke through with a 4-3 win in 10 innings to knock off MOC Floyd Valley. At the bottom of the 10th inning, Bryce Click singled with one out to put a runner on for the Warriors. Click worked his way to third on back-to-back wild pitches, but Jackson VanDenBosch was able to strike out Easton Wheeler to get the second out. With two outs, the Dutchman decided to walk Aiden Cepeda intentionally to face Tyler Lutgen. Lutgen made them pay with a line drive that hit the pitcher, VanDenBosch, and sorted Click to win the game. Quote, the nerves really starting to kick in, Lutgen said. Aiden got intentionally walked the at-bat before me, so I felt like I had really something to prove right there. Just getting the job done for my team was all I really worried about, and I got it done. VanDenBosch will be okay and was checked out by the trainer after the game, MOC Floyd Valley coach Brian Wedd said. The loss ended a 17-game win streak for the Dutchmen, who now sit with a 25-3 record. This was a really good high school baseball game with both teams really getting after it and trying their best to win, and with maybe some of their game of their top arms not available, Weed said. Quote, it was a really fun game to be a part of and a lot of really good things on both sides that we can take away from it going into the postseason. Lutgen pitched 3 no-hit innings to start the game Friday night, finishing with 5 innings of work, striking out 4. At the plate, Spirita and Drake Van Meter drove in 1 RBI each in the first inning to give Sergeant Bluff Luton a 2-0 lead after 1 inning of play. A double play by Blake Albers drove in Cooper Huss to cut the lead to 2-1. Cole Conlon added a run on a solo home run to lead off the bottom of the 4th inning, and the lead was back to 2. Nikolai Wedd hit a solo home run to lead off the top of the 5th, and Huss hit a sacrifice to score a run to tie the game 3-3 later in the inning. Conlon came in to pitch the 6th inning for the Warriors, and he knocked down the Dutchman. Nelson has been proud of what Cepeda, Click, and Conlon have accomplished on the baseball field. Our 3 seniors are 3 super special kids. They're all going to go to school to play at Northwestern, and you know, I'm just really happy for them, Nelson said. There's sometimes a lot of pressure that kids put on themselves in big games like that, and I felt that a little bit. But I was glad they were able to kind of get over that and then shine in certain moments. Bryce did an awesome job behind the plate like he always does. Cole with the big hit and coming in to kind of shut the door. They have super good offense, so I was glad he was able to come in. And we planned on him only throwing a couple innings, and he ended up throwing a few more than that. He did everything we asked him tonight, Nelson continued. Wade said the loss needed to be a learning experience heading into playoff baseball next week. Errors like the wild pitches in the 10th inning came back to bite MOC Floyd Valley last Friday night. Quote, it just goes to show how important the little things are, you know, Weed said. Some of the innings that we gave up runs, we were giving up free bases with errors or wild pitches or whatever, and those are the kinds of things that cause you to lose games. So hopefully our guys learned that we have to be able to get in the strike zone and not walk guys, and we have to make plays and not throw wild pitches and pass balls and that sort of stuff. The win for the third-seeded Warriors over the top-seeded Dutchman gives Sergeant Bluff Luton some added confidence leading into the district playoffs next week. The Warriors have one final game against Spencer next week before starting the district tournament. Quote, I think you kind of remind your kids or kind of giving them that little bit of that nugget that you are a good team, Nelson said. Like you're able to beat the number one team in our sub-state in a close game, and a lot of things could have happened where it maybe went the other way, but we were able to pull it out, and yeah, if you don't get the confidence from winning a tight extra inning game like that, then I don't know what else to tell you. That's going to hopefully give you some confidence. All right, we will return back to the sports section with some pro baseball from the Sioux City Explorers. Headline, Amaral starts weekend off with a bang. From Sioux City, Danny Amaral trusted his instinct when he needed it most on Friday night. The former Pittsburgh Pirates prospect hit a three-run, game-winning home run to give the Sioux City Explorers a 5-3 win over Winnipeg at Lewis and Clark Park. Amaral knew that he was going to see an off-speed pitch in the 11th inning, and he pounded the pitch over the left field wall to give the Exes the series-opening win. Quote, I saw one pitch and I was looking for a pitch over the plate and I was lucky to get one, Amaral said. I put a good swing on it. Their pitching staff did a great job and Chase Harris did a great job getting a hit in the 11th inning, and that changed the momentum of the game. In Amaral's fifth at-bat of the night, he was looking for an off-speed pitch. He ended up striking out swinging in the 9th inning, but Amaral didn't change his approach. He was still confident he was going to see the pitch he wanted. Amaral and manager Steve Montgomery discussed the at-bat, and Montgomery trusted that his left fielder was going to get the job done if he had come up to bat again. Quote, the players aren't always going to agree with me, and I'm not always going to agree with them, but if they have a plan, stick to it, Montgomery said. I'll be damned if he didn't get an off-speed pitch over the plate, and he deposited it. He has an idea of what he's going to do. He sticks to the plan, and he figures out a way to get it done. Quote, he's done everything we've asked him to do, Montgomery said. He's played at second and at left. He's a great kid. His dad, Rich Amaral, played in the big leagues. He just loves the game of baseball. It's the second straight season Amaral has hit a game-winning homer. He did so with the Altoona Curve, the AA affiliate of the Pirates. He came against the Somerset Yankees. It was great, and it was a cool feeling, Amaral said. Amaral's home run was his fourth of 2022, and his 22nd in his college summer ball and professional career. His season high in homers is 7, and that happened last year with the Curve. The Explorers scored both of their regulation runs early in the game. They scored once in the second and once in the third. Blake Tiberi scored on a fielder's choice in the second inning. Nate Sampson had an RBI ground out in the third inning that scored Trey Martin. Winnipeg scored one during the third inning off a Logan Hill home run, and then again in the several inning via an RBI single from Raul Navarro. The Explorers had chances to score late in the game. They had the bases loaded in the eighth inning, but the Goldeyes got out of the jam by forcing Zach Cone to ground out. Sioux City packed the bases again in the ninth, but Winnipeg escaped in that threat there too. Montgomery was just relieved that the Explorers were able to come away with a win to start the holiday weekend. Quote, the record doesn't show that how hard these guys work, the Exes manager said. Today was the best day that you could be a Sioux City Explorer. The reason why, we had the Miracle League in from 3 to 6 o'clock. Seeing joy on those kids' faces and then to hit a walk-off, are you kidding me? Question mark. Today is my favorite day. I love the Miracle League and I love that we associate ourselves with them. Montgomery reminds his players every year how much it means for the Miracle League players to step out onto the field at Lewis and Clark Park and spend 3 hours with the Explorers. Quote, this is their big league opportunity, Montgomery said. It was just great seeing some familiar faces after doing this for so long. Kevin Nagard does a great job over there, and that's just a wonderful organization. The Explorers are at home for the remainder of the holiday weekend with 7:05 p.m. home games against the Goldeyes on Sunday and Monday. There are fireworks shows scheduled after both games. All right, we'll continue through the sports section to page B3 for girls basketball, where we look to Fremont coach Kelly Flynn. Headline, from South Sioux to Fremont, Flynn finds more hoop success. Subheadline, former South Sioux City coach named Omaha World Herald's Girls Coach of the Year. From Fremont, Nebraska. It was 1997 when Kelly Flynn was first named the World Herald's Girls Coach of the Year. 25 years later, history repeats itself. Flynn earns the honor after leading Fremont to its first girls basketball championship. He adds that title to 11 state crowns his squad earned at South Sioux City from 1995 to 2008. Quote, there were differences in the two programs, he said, but there are a lot of similarities, starting with players who were committed to our ultimate goal. The 27-2 Tigers capped their best season ever, defeating Lincoln Southwest in the Class A final. It was the culmination of 4 years of hard work put in by Flynn, who returned to the coaching ranks at Fremont before the 2018-2019 season. Being a sideline mentor has been in Flynn's blood since his elementary school days in Parker, South Dakota. Growing up as the youngest of seven, Flynn said he knew in fourth grade that coaching would be his destiny. Quote, "My brother Ron was going to college to be a coach," he said. "I thought that sounded like a pretty neat deal." Flynn played four sports at Parker High School before moving on to college in South Dakota. He got the opportunity to student teach and coach at South Sioux before graduating with a physical education and health degree. He was a boys' basketball assistant for 4 years before taking over the girls' basketball program for the 1984 through 1985 season. Quote, "The principal talked me into that," he said. "I thought I'd try it for a few years to see if it worked out." It definitely worked out as Flynn turned the school into a girls' basketball powerhouse. The first state tournament appearance came in 1987, and 8 years later, the Cardinals won their first of 11 championships under his guidance. Quote, "Once we really did get things rolling, it just kept building," he said. "The feeder program, the volunteer assistant coaches, our own coaching staff, and of course the players willing to put in a ton of time." One coach Flynn impressed during his early days at South Sioux was John Larson, who went on to become the state's all-time coaching wins leader. Quote, "We met at a coaching clinic when he first started," Larson said. "I knew by his enthusiasm and interest that he had a great future ahead of him." Larson added that it wasn't just the Cardinals' offense. The school averaged a state record of 93.6 points one season, but the team's defense that led to all those championships. Flynn stepped away from the coaching in 2013 and took a position at South Sioux City's Director of Economic Development. That lasted 6 years until he got the urge to once again return to the sideline. "Quite, I looked at another job opportunity somewhere else," he said. "I was a little nervous about that because there was a comfort level that came with being in the same town for 30 plus years. There were girls basketball coaching vacancies at Fremont and in Omaha Scott." Flynn said he applied first with the Tigers, and if turned down, he would have focused his attention on the Skyhawks. That never happened because of Fremont athletic director Scott Anderson and his school search committee. Quote, "We knew 2 minutes into the interview that Kelly was our guy," he said. "I could tell that he still had a lot of gas left in his tank." Flynn's arrival at the school coincided with the appearance of highly regarded freshman named Taylor McCabe. The Tigers previously had been to the state tournament 6 times, but had never won a game. That changed in Flynn's second season when Fremont reached the semifinals, and another step was taken the following year when the Tigers reached the final, losing to Lincoln Pius X. With the return of 6 starters, including the high-scoring McCabe, Fremont had high hopes entering the season. That optimism was tempered when the Tigers lost their opening game to Pius in double overtime. Quote, "I wanted to play them right away," Flynn said. "It was a measuring stick for where we were at, and it showed we still had hard work to do." The Tigers responded with 17 straight wins, leading to perhaps the team's most important game of the season. Fremont led Lincoln High by 20 points at home before the Lynx rallied for a 68-64 victory. Quote, "Looking back, that was probably the best thing for us," Flynn said. "It was a stunning wake-up call, but it really refocused us." Fremont won its next 7 games and headed back to state with the dream of that first state title. Payback wins over Pius and Lincoln High led to a second straight berth in the Class A final against Lincoln Southwest. In a defensive battle, Fremont prevailed 37-32 to capture the championship. Quote, "I've gone back and watched the replay of that game on tape, and I still get nervous," Flynn said. "I'll always remember the tears of joy after the game because there's no better feeling." McCabe, the state's Gatorade Player of the Year, said Flynn deserves credit for what he's achieved with the school's program. Quote, "It's crazy that we came in at the same time. I'm so thankful for that," she said. Quote, "He made us work hard, but he was always supportive and he always got the most out of us." Flynn said the contribution made by McCabe, who finished her career number 3 on the state's all-time scoring list with 2,313 points, can't be denied. Quote, "To get the opportunity to coach a player like that was special," he said. "She was part of a great group of seniors that I'll never forget." Flynn also credited his family for its constant support over the years. That begins with his wife, Barb, who has been married to Kelly for 41 years. Flynn will enter next season with 597 career wins, 6 on the state's all-time list. The recently retired Larson is the state leader with 638. Quote, "Being the all-time leader is not a goal of mine," Flynn said, "but if it happens, it's a reflection of the great assistant coaches and players I've had over the years." Let's now turn to the business section B of today's Sunday paper. Headline, producing pork for four decades. Subheadline, Tyson's Storm Lake Pork Plant marks 40th anniversary, from Storm Lake, Iowa. Tyson Foods is celebrating its 40th year slaughtering and processing pork in Storm Lake. In 1982, Iowa Beef Processors, a forerunner to Tyson, purchased the then-vacant plant from High Grade Food Products and remodeled it extensively. It was IVP's first venture into pork production. High Grade, which had once been Storm Lake's largest employer, made clear the pork plant wasn't doing well as early as 1978 and made plans to close due to a dwindling local hog supply, increased operating costs, and labor difficulties. It remained open for a time, but by October 1981, with the plant losing money, High Grade closed it down. Roughly 500 jobs were lost. Storm Lake civic leaders cheered IBP's $2.5 million purchase of the plant in April of the following year. When an IBP airplane landed at Storm Lake's airport on the day of the announcement, they were met by an entourage of 8 cars plus a police escort. Cheerleaders and a band played for the IBP delegation. Hiring began in early September 1982, according to journal archival information, with the base hourly rate of between $6 and $7. Then Iowa Governor Robert Ray and U.S. Representative Rep. Berkeley Bedell were on hand for the occasion when the plant resumed operations that month under new ownership. Quote, there's a real positive attitude here. It's good to have the enthusiasm and support of the community. Bruce Pausch, an IVP spokesman, said in 1982 when the hiring began at the Storm Lake plant. IBP initially hired 350 employees for one daily production shift at the plant, a Tyson spokeswoman said. Today, the plant employs around 2,300 and runs two production shifts and one maintenance and sanitation shift. The plant has been expanded significantly from what IVP acquired 40 years ago. It's now more than 300,000 square feet. The sprawling facility was built in numerous phases. Certain parts of it date back to the early 1930s, when other parts were built at various points between the 1940s and 1990s. More recent additions were in 2016 and 2019, according to Buena Vista County property records. Tyson does not disclose the amount of pork produced at the plant, but a spokeswoman said that it processes more than three times what it did in 1982. The plant produces fresh box pork products for retail and food service, raw pork material sent to case-ready plants, which take larger cuts of meat and prepare them into cuts for retail, and pork products for export. When IBP opened the plant in 1982, company officials expected 7,000 hogs to be processed in an 8-hour shift. IBP was acquired by Tyson in 2001 for $3.2 billion. Tyson also operates a turkey complex in Storm Lake, one of the largest turkey processors in the country, which was acquired upon Tyson's purchase of Hillshire Brands for more than $8.5 billion in 2014. Tyson's turkey operations in Storm Lake employ around 750 people. Mary Berg was 22 years old when she began a job with an IBP construction crew working on the remodeling of the pork plant. When the plant began production later that year, she became a gam cutter on the harvest floor. Quote, I come from an early Iowa, and I was living in Sac City at the time. I was without a job, and one of my best friend's dad said, you better get up there if you want a job, said Berg, now 62 and a training specialist of the plant. I went up right away and was hired right away. Berg is one of 10 current employees who've been working at the plant all 40 years Tyson has operated it. The others are Richard Zwemke, Ivan Schwaller, John Wallery, Jerry Moreland, Ron Peters, Mark Thompson, Keith Benningdorfs, Dan Coleman, and Nick Lovan. Quote, when you're working in a place like that, you become family. You work with everybody. That many hours a day, that many days a week, they become your second family, Berg said. To celebrate the 40th anniversary, Tyson donated more than 40,000 pounds of meat to local food pantries and organizations and gave five donations of $4,000 to five organizations. The Upper Des Moines Opportunity, CASA, C-A-A-S-A, Ready, Set, Grow, Storm Lake Police Department's Mini Pitch Project, and the Storm Lake Rotary Club. All right, with our remaining time together, let's now do Dear Abby. Headline, grandparents have opinions on what's best for young man. Dear Abby, our 26-year-old college-educated grandson, Ethan, crashed his company car and was arrested for DWI in possession of more than a gram of cocaine. His mother hired a lawyer, posted bond, and is taking full charge of the situation. Ethan lost his responsible job, and his girlfriend kicked him out. He has a sizable inheritance, enough to pay the lawyer and fine. Since he has never been in trouble before, we are hoping he won't go to jail. Although we love Ethan dearly, his dad and I agree he should handle this on his own without his mother, who is recently divorced from our son, running to his rescue. Ethan also needs to help out with his addictions. He has enough 529 account funds to turn this serious mistake into an opportunity to return to college and get a master's degree. I don't know how much to get involved directly with Ethan or his mother. Though my wife and I are on good terms with his mother, it appears she doesn't want our advice. I welcome your suggestions on what to do. Signed, Upset Granddad in Texas. Dear Granddad, you can voice your opinion, but beyond that, you should stay out of it. A well-meaning as you are, you can't force your former daughter-in-law, who is in full mother mode, or Ethan to abandon the path they are on. All you can do is point out the dangers they may encounter along the way and hope they will listen, however frustrating it may be. Dear Abby, my fiancé and I recently moved to a new area because his job was relocated. He was really excited to start his new adventure, and I was happy to come along. We've been together for 10 years, high school sweethearts, and we got engaged just before we moved. I noticed he had been Snapchatting with someone. When I asked him about it, he refused to tell me who, but said I shouldn't be concerned. Eventually, he did tell me. It's a female coworker. I don't know much about her other than she is recently divorced. I'm happy she's out of a bad situation, but I don't understand why she's Snapchatting my fiancé. I also don't understand why he hid it from me until I made a big deal of it. There are other details about her, which I'm not sure are 100% true, that could change my point of view about this. But since I don't know her, they are hard for me to believe. Should I be concerned, or is my anxiety taking over? I'll be addressing this with him again, but I'm not going to blow it up in his face about it. Signed, Doubting in South Dakota. Abby writes, Dear Doubting, I'm glad you're not going to blow up because all it would do is make your fiancé defensive. You do, however, need to have a discussion with him about this coworker. If you feel he has been completely honest about her or her circumstances and as he has become secretive, recognize it as a huge red flag and proceed from there. Do not get married before this is resolved. All right, well, that draws our time together to a close, so we will now just do a quick recap of the weather. Again, we're well into July now, so we're well into the summer heat. Today, it'll be very warm, breezy in the afternoon, high of 90. Tonight, humid, strong thunderstorm late in the evening, low of 74. Monday, heavy thunderstorm in the morning, but still a high of 100. Winds 10 to 20 miles per hour, any low of 74. Tuesday, hot with clouds and sun, high of 99, low of 71. Wednesday, very warm with clouds and sun, high of 94, low of 70. Thursday, humid with thunderstorm in spots, high of 89, low of 67. And, well, that brings us to the end of Iris for Sunday, July 3rd, 2022. I hope you all have a wonderful week and that your 4th of July is safe and happy and fun. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.